You're tuning in to Guacamole, a collaborative podcast series on food by The Slow Press and Neighbor. In each episode, we dive into what lies beyond the stated necessities of a recipe, giving rise to the exploration of the stories and experiences shared by a new guest from the local culinary scene in Singapore. Scraps is the one word that we want to discuss and take inspiration from in this series. For me, it reminds me of the lesser used parts of ingredients, like the husk of corn, the tough, fibrous bits of vegetables, the fats we render from an animal, the bones that we usually discard without a second thought. Slowly, through my own exploration while tasting different kinds of food cooked by family or in restaurants, and picking up cooking at home, I've realized that these parts that we commonly disregard and discard can add another dimension of flavor to things that we cook. I am your host, Christy, and today we will be inviting our guest, Ryan Newman, to share his take on scraps through his family's recipe for pepper water. Ryan is currently the head chef of Le Bon Funk, a natural wine bar down at Club Street in Singapore. Born in Penang, he grew up in a Eurasian family and that exposed him to a lot of Anglo-Indian food. He spent some time in the south of France during his internships in several restaurants, then worked at Cure, a one Michelin star modern Irish restaurant in Singapore, among other stints in Penang during the pandemic. Hey Ryan, we're super happy to have you here with us today. So I heard you just came off the plane. Like, where do you come from?
Yeah, no. Thank you for having me. This is great. First time on a podcast.
How does it feel?
Yeah, it feels good. I mean, I don't know. We'll see how today goes, right?
It's gonna be fun. I promise.
Yeah, just think of it as a conversation, right?
Yes. Mm. So let us just jump straight in. So, what was the dish that you grew up eating the most?
The most?
Okay, maybe not the most, but like, what's your favorite dish?
Oh, there's a few dishes that I have very fond memories of. So growing up, my paternal grandmom and granddad lived with us. And so they were basically like the, you know, the people who would cook for us, take care of us. Parents out working, obviously. So most of the food that I grew up eating was my grandmom's food. So I have very fond memories of the stuff that she makes, the stuff that she made me. I think growing up, I was a very, very fussy kid, really fussy eater. I never really I was very picky what I put in my mouth and what I ate. Anything outside of like my grandmom's food, even when we go out, was very... wasn't a lot of choices, I guess. I liked fish and chips outside. I ate wonton mee, and that was basically all I ate outside, really. So most of the food I ate was at home, and my grandma used to make a few different things, which are quite unique, I would think. I would say not many friends that I had growing up ate the same things I did.
Right. Was it because they were from like a different culture from
yourself? I think more so I was from a different culture. Like, I didn't have a lot of other Eurasian friends. I mean, I had a lot of Eurasian friends, but they were more like Chinese or Indian. But I was like, I don't know, my mom was Chinese, but I didn't really have a lot of Chinese food growing up. I had more what my grandma makes. So there'd be like stuffed eggplants, like eggplant stuffed with mint. We'll have like devil's curry, which was kind of... you know, like it's a very staple Eurasian dish, but like I said, I didn't know a lot of other Eurasians growing up who ate the same things I did. So I always thought like devil's curry was just like another curry, right? Like another gravy that was more common. But right. When I spoke about it, nobody I spoke about it to knew what it was. So that was that. And there was like fish molly, which is another type of fish curry gravy, almost like masak lemak from the Malays. It's very similar. And pepper water curry, which is, I guess, what we're talking about today. So pepper water curry is one of my favorite dishes that my grandma made. It's very similar to an Indian rasam. Mm. Well, I have really fond memories of this dish, though. It's it reminds me of Christmas time. Christmas was like a big thing in my family, right? Growing up Catholic and that. So we would always have this dish Christmas Eve after church. So it would be late at night. Church Christmas Eve would be like 11 to 12. We'll finish like, yeah, midnight. We'll get back. And I used to grow up like on a hill
in Penang. Oh,
cute. Yeah, on an apartment in a hill. So I lived on like the sixth floor. But that was like a 5-story car park beneath the building. So it was like 11th floor. And it was on a hill. So it was super windy come Christmas time. And it was like really cold. Like the winds are nuts. That was one time like the wind was so strong it blew down like the balcony doors. It was like that crazy. So it was really, really cold. Christmas time was very cold. I mean, cold in a Malaysian, Singaporean context.
Yeah, that like, sounds incredible. Like how?
Yeah, so pepper water curry was like a really hearty, brothy, warm dish that you know, was very fitting of that night, I would say. But again, it's like, you know, not... Like you think about Christmas food, you don't think about this.
Exactly, that's right? What I was going to ask you.
So it was something very unique to, I guess, my experience. And I don't know how many other families out there, Eurasian or not, who have had this dish, especially during Christmas time. But for us, it was like a yearly thing. So we'll have this, and then we'll have like also like cheese platters and other stuff around. So it was very, you know, mix and match thing. But this was like a mainstay through my growing up years, I guess. Yeah.
I think what's interesting is that you ate a lot of like Indian influenced food growing up. And I would think that those are very like strong flavored and very spicy kind of dishes.
Well, I wouldn't say they were like spicy. I mean, apart from like devil's curry, I don't think we had a lot of spicy dishes in my household. Like a lot of the other quote unquote curries that I grew up with were like spiced, but not spicy.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Full of spice.
But yeah, definitely strong flavors, bold flavors, and yeah, that's what I grew up with, and that's why I still gravitate to these days in terms of finding the food I like. It's always searching out for the more intensely flavored stuff. So much so that sometimes when I want to appreciate like lighter flavored things, like a nice pure dashi or you know, like a good sashimi or something like that, I always feel like from an art point of view, like I can appreciate it, but does it actually like satisfy me on a soul level? Like not really.
Right.
Like I always feels like something's missing almost.
Right.
Yeah.
Will you say that shaped most of like your palate and like how 100%. You cook now?
Yeah. Yeah. I always find like I guess when I create food now, I always find that I'm searching for that moment. You know when you eat something, you just go, oh, and your knees go weak. And you're just like, yes. Like, I'm looking for that. Yes. And if I don't find that moment, it's not good enough.
Oh, that's going to be really hard for you to eat anything.
Yeah, my girlfriend calls me a snob, definitely. Like, oh, this is not good enough for you and I'm so scared to cook.
Yeah, but back
maybe
to
we should
the...
cut that part out before she hears it.
Oh, no. Yeah, but just going back to the pepper water, like if you don't eat it for Christmas, when do people usually eat the dish?
Well, no, we don't only eat it for Christmas, but Christmas time was the only time. I mean, it was always like it was always there during Christmas time. But yeah, we had it through the year. There was no like real occasion to have it with besides for Christmas. You know, we have it from day to day type of thing.
And what are the ingredients that go into making it?
Well, okay, that's basically two parts to this. One is making like the stock, making the base stock, and then infusing that with more spices. So the first step is the making of the stock. So normally like I guess why we always had it during Christmas Eve, because Christmas Eve lunch we always have like a roast chicken and stuffing and stuff. So we always have like leftover chicken or chicken carcasses that you know you can't eat obviously. So with the chicken carcasses we'll turn that into the stock in which we'll cook the soup with. So the stock, there's like a bunch of spices, cumin, coriander, some chilies, pepper, obviously, turmeric, and tamarind water. So we'll infuse that all into the stock with the chicken carcasses that were roasted and left over from lunch. And then with that, we'll fortify it even more in a separate pot with like your curry leaves, your onions and your garlic, all the aromats. And then you infuse this stock into that pot of aromats. And then you would add all your shredded chicken, or if you have your leftover chicken from lunch, with tomatoes and stuff. So that's basically it, really.
That sounds really flavorful. Mm. Just listening to you list out all the ingredients.
Definitely. And I think like just finishing it with more like fresh tomatoes, and my grandma always used to put like you know, like just fried shallots.
Yes, of course.
Just like a bunch of those on.
Damn, okay.
Yeah, it was very hearty, very comforting for sure.
And yeah. Just now you mentioned about like using parts of the chicken, like the carcasses and parts that you can't really eat.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is that common in your family to do so?
You know, if I'm really honest with you, growing up, I was never involved with like cooking with my family.
That's fair. Yeah.
So I can't say for sure that like practicing zero waste is something that's very common in my family. But, you know, we would always finish whatever we cook. You know, my family, you know, they come from, you know, not a very well-to-do background. Both my grandparents, they come from poverty pretty much. And so this attitude of not wasting anything, it's very ingrained in them. And so we don't really like, you know, throw away food. We always make sure we finish it, or if we don't finish it, we keep it in the fridge, use it the next day. But in terms of recycling like carcasses and like stuff like that, I think we only pretty much buy what we use and don't waste what we make. Now that, you know, we have the benefit of hindsight and me learning to cook professionally, like I can obviously look at it from a different perspective, from a different point of view, and think of it more technically and how we can reuse the waste. So I guess now, I mean, besides the example of you know, using that chicken carcasses and make the stock, I can't really think of any other instances that, you know, we have much wastage at all.
Right.
Because no, like fine. I said, you know, like roast chicken was also like a special meal. It was like a Christmas Eve lunch type of thing.
Right.
So it was also very, very few and very, very rare that we would have that like a whole animal type of thing.
Right. Yeah.
But for us, it's more like keeping leftovers, eating it the next day, that type of thing, you know? And I think it's kind of similar for a lot of families too. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm assuming.
I think it's very important for people to like take note of that like now, because I feel like because of convenience, people are not like cooking as much anymore. Yeah. And when they start cooking something, it's like for the novelty of it, they're like, let me try cooking this.
Mm.
And then they have to buy like a bottle of like spices or like something. And then they use it once and they
right.
just don't really cook it anymore.
Yeah. I guess I felt that way like going through college and all that, you know, like just moving to a new town, having a kitchen with like a zero pantry stuff. Like,
yeah.
You know, you got to buy all your staples, you got to buy all your soy sauce and your spices and stuff.
Mm.
But, you know, at home, where obviously my grandmom cooks every day, she has her pantry and she has her, you know, go-to recipes that are all quite similar, just, you know, tweaked in a way or two to keep things interesting, right? But yeah, I mean, growing up, even though, you know, we've always had, I was always very, I'm very blessed to have my grandmom with me growing up. She cooked for us every day. I never had the same meal like 2 days in a row, pretty much, you know. I was a very lucky kid. I honestly, sometimes I wish I spent more time in the kitchen with her growing up, now that, you know. But I was never like into cooking until like I was 18.
Mm.
So, and at that point, she barely cooked anymore.
Right.
So I just wish, you know, like I spent more time with her in the kitchen. Like I said, I was a very, very fussy kid. I always wanted to go out and play instead.
But then yeah. How do you learn this recipe from her?
From my aunt and my mom. So my grandmom had 6 kids. And my dad was the only guy in the family. So she had 5 daughters. Some of them are still around in Malaysia. Some of them have, you know, have gone on to live elsewhere. But yeah, I mean, growing up, going through uni and learning how to cook, I was always, you know, left wanting to learn what I grew up with. You know, I felt like, yeah, it's an important part of me. And I feel like my culinary education would not be complete without me understanding a bit, at least, of what I grew up with. So that was when I was messaging them and asking them about this recipe and that recipe. And they always kept, like, my grandma had like this handwritten old notebook, right? All the recipes, and all her recipes are in obviously not grams and stuff. It's in like cups and this. And it's like this specific ladle, this specific dragon design ladle, or this cap, like this cap that closed this jar, like, you know, one that was her measurements. So reading through it was very interesting. And, you know, recipes, some would be in English, some would be like the ingredients would be in Malay. So it was really fascinating trying to decipher it. And
I think it's very personal and intimate as well.
Yeah, definitely. It was like a bittersweet feeling, you know. Like I said, like I wish I spent more time, but also privileged enough to have this book with me now. And also, like, I felt at that point in my life, again, a little bit of a food snob, like me thinking like, oh, I'm studying culinary professionally now. Like, I can improve upon these recipes by tweaking a little thing here and there. And trying it and cooking it for my family. And they go like, yeah, it's good. But, you know, it's not the same as grandma. Well, yeah, obviously it's not the same as grandma. She's been doing this for 50 years.
And like, when your mom and your aunts cook it, does it taste the same? Or like, do they have their own like riff of it?
I think, no, it doesn't taste the same 100%. You know, I think they would admit it as well. Sometimes they would cook something and be like, it's missing this, it's missing something, but I can't really put a finger on it. And it's always that feeling, you know, whether it's actually like an actual thing or just a feeling that's in the head that, you know, it's not cooked by grandma.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know. But yeah, I mean, it was still in the ballpark of what it is, you know. So it's good enough, I guess.
Does your family still make it on Christmas these days?
Yeah, I think last year we did. I don't know, man. My you know, since moving to Singapore and having a job, obviously Christmas Eve is like a busy day, and I haven't been back for Christmas in a while.
Oh, that's so sad.
No, yeah, because it's life, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, this year definitely the restaurant's closed for Christmas, so I definitely wanna make this on my own and see how it goes.
Then maybe your aunt will be like, your version is like the closest to grandma's.
I don't know. it might backfire.
Right.
Who knows? But definitely, definitely. And my whole family is gonna be back in Penang this Christmas. So I definitely wanna, you know, not let anyone down.
That's very nice. Yeah. I'm so excited for you.
Yeah, it is exciting.
And thanks for sharing like this very sentimental story. Like, I really want to see the recipe book of your grandma's.
Oh, I don't know whether I can find some photos right now. I definitely have if I dig enough, but we'll see. I'm sure I can find like a few pages of pictures in my aunt's and.
Yeah, that'd be so cute. Next time, whenever you find it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we'll pass the time over to Kevin.
So in the first part of this conversation, you mentioned pepper water. Is it a popular dish? Because I've never heard of it. And this is the first time I'm seeing these two words together, pepper and water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know actually whether... Okay. Growing up, I never knew whether pepper water was actually a thing or whether it's something that my grandmom coined. But two Christmases ago, my auntie... who lives in India right now, right? She gave me a recipe book called Anglo-Indian like recipes and something like that. And in that book, I found a lot of the things that my grandmom cooked for me growing up. So that was like my first indication of, well, that's actually like a way bigger cultural significance than just what I thought in my head was something my grandmom coined, you know? So yeah, I guess in a certain context, it
is actually a thing. I haven't really explored more into where that society is or, you know, but it's actually a legit thing. And so that actually also took me by surprise. But yeah, I think it's like I said, it's very similar to like a rasam that you get at a banana leaf restaurant or whatever. I think what the difference of pepper water and rasam is the, I think there's more spices in the rasam and also the way that the pepper water is finished with like the fried shallots and stuff and like some coriander, fresh coriander leaves, and you don't find that in rasams. So I think that is it, but that is just, you know, the only pepper water I've had in my life was my grandmom's pepper water. Or rather my family's now. So I don't know whether that's her tweak on it or actually like the legit pepper water thing, you know? Like, I think also like a lot of dishes around the world, like it's super regional, right? So it might...
They have their own spin on things?
It may be that too. So yeah.
And in the first part of this conversation, you mentioned that you've never really thought of yourself wanting to cook or wanting to be a chef until you were 18. What changed?
Well, actually like... So in Malaysia, when you're 17, you go for this big exam, right, called SPM that basically... tells you whether or not you're qualified to go to uni or like puts you into streams.
I think we have those here as well.
I'm pretty sure. O-levels, I think.
Probably,
I think
it's, one of those things,
So, I wasn't a very good student. I was pretty much like slacking off like 16, 17 years old. But then like 17, I knew like, I got to get my stuff together for this exam. I have a lot to catch up on, so I just planned like a schedule for myself that I'm going to study for 40 minutes and have a little break 15 minutes, and that's like one session, and do that for like 3-4 times a day. So during those 15 minutes to like cool down, I was just I just go on YouTube and watch videos, and then one day I just stumbled upon Gordon Ramsay. And his videos. And I was like, something about that really attracted me, and also like listening to his story of like, you know, he was going to be a football player. And then he got an injury, and that's how he got into cooking. And what really resonated with him was like the intensity of being in a kitchen or being a professional kitchen. And I, because Ramsay at the time, he, you know, there wasn't just like MasterChef, right? That was like MasterChef. That was like the F word. That was like Kitchen Nightmares. There was a whole bunch of series to look at the restaurant business and working in a kitchen from a lot of point of views. And so I guess I had a really holistic picture of what I would sign up for. At that point, it was just like a, well, I'm really into the drama. I'm really into, like, I really resonated with the energy too. But I guess I started getting into cooking actually one weekend when my mom was actually meant to cook dinner and she was caught up with something. She was late. So I was like, you know, like, let me just do something. So it was literally like the first time I've ever cooked for my family. I don't even remember what I made, but it probably wasn't very good. And then that's when I had like, you know, that was when the seed was planted in my head that it was something I could do. I knew at that point in time I didn't want to be confined to a desk and have like the, you know, like a desk job or 9-to-5. I needed something with more energy, you know. I was very involved in sports all my life and I needed some outlet for that energy. Just the idea that seed that was planted just grew into a passion, into an obsession. And I decided, I was like, you know what, let's just I wanted to do culinary school, definitely. My mom and dad supported that too. So I was very, very lucky to have like very supportive parents. But basically after the exam, I had like a 2-month break. It was like November, December time. And so I was like, all right, let's test this idea. Let's see how it actually is like working in a professional kitchen. So there was one like deli in Penang that my mom really liked, and the chef there is like a German guy. He actually had a show on AFC, Asian Food Channel. And like I went to this cafe once and you know, I knew they were doing things like making homemade sausages. You know, first time I tried blue cheese was like there, and it was like a gorgonzola and rocket sandwich and a focaccia, and it was my first time in my life trying blue cheese. But I was like, it was, I still remember it was like a 16 ringgit sandwich, and at that point it was like expensive to pay anything above like 10 ringgit for a sandwich, right? So my mom was like, you sure you want this? You like blue cheese? He was like, oh, actually, when I ordered it, the guy was like, oh, this is blue cheese. And my mom was like, you like blue cheese? And I was like, yeah, I like blue cheese. Yeah. What are you talking about? Of course, yeah. I like blue cheese. Took a bite, absolutely hated it.
Yeah.
But forced myself to eat it because you paid 17 ringgit for a sandwich. Yeah. So I was like, all right, my mom was like, just talk to the chef, ask him whether you can see what's it like. So I did. His name is Tom. Remember Chef Tom? He had like a mohawk.
Oh, it's pretty tight.
Yeah. It's pretty tight, yeah. He was like, can I like just come and work for you for free for a while, just see how it feels? And so he agreed, and I showed up the next morning, 8 a.m.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a Saturday, I remember very clearly. 8 a.m. and one of the first things I did was clean chicken livers.
Mm.
So when you order chicken livers, it comes with like the heart and maybe the bile sac, which is like green and nasty. So you need to peel those off of the livers, and then you would marinate the livers to make a chicken liver mousse. So I did that, and it was like, I think a kilo or two of chicken livers, and I was gagging all the way. And I was just like, I guess I was very prone or very sensitive to strong smells. Mm. And that was one of the very strong smell things, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't very pleasant. Mm. But at the end of the day, I was like, yeah, I enjoyed it.
You went back for the second day?
I went back the second day. I did that for about a month, I think. And I was like, yeah, you know what? I guess I could do this.
Mm.
You know? My parents are very skeptical because I never cooked my whole life.
I wanted to ask, was it a surprise to your family that was even something that you wanted to do?
Yeah, big surprise. Even to myself, I think. Even going through culinary school, like I know my parents invested a lot into culinary school because it wasn't cheap, right? It was like, I don't know, like 40K a semester or some shit.
Damn, okay.
So I was very afraid of changing my mind halfway and dropping out. I always like, you know, I was very afraid of that because I feel like I can very easily bury those feelings. But even if you, no matter how good you bury feelings, one day it's going to come and bite you if it's not what you want to do, right? Yep. But yeah, so I guess even all through culinary school, in which like I was very excited to be a part of and I was very happy, there was always that doubt in the back of my head, like, is this actually what you want? Because like I knew that, you know, from watching all those Ramsay videos and shows, like culinary school is the easiest bit of it.
Mm.
Like, you know, you don't work 12, 14, 15, it's what 16 comes after hours. It, yeah. You know, it's like, it's all the, you know, it's the sunny days in culinary school. It's the easy, like, yeah, you go for a 4-hour class and you're done. And then you go out with your friends at night and have some fun. And the next day you show up to like a 8 o'clock class at 8:30. You walk in there and it's chill and you learn about all these theory stuff. But like, you know, after culinary school is when the real stuff happens, right? You work like 14, 15, 16 hours.
Yeah.
You know, you go to bed, your feet aches, you're thinking about what you're going to do the next day. You're worried that the chef is going to show up with a bad mood and make your day miserable, you know, all these things. So there was always this doubt at the back of my head, like, is this actually what you want? Are you sure you know what you're signing up for? Mm-hmm. You know, but like I said, I think what I was really drawn to was the energy and the camaraderie and that you get from working in a professional kitchen.
Yeah.
And I, you know, later on in my career, I find out that I guess I do what I do because I love taking care of people and creating an experience for them, creating like a facilitating a time for them to have a good time.
Yeah.
You know? And the food is almost like a byproduct of it, you know? It's just you being there, working very closely with a team, all working towards the same goal.
Yeah.
And that is why I wake up, you know? Like, that motivates me, that energizes me. And just to create like an environment for people to have a good time.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the food is just a byproduct. And that's what really matters to me at the end of the day.
I have to ask, what was the moment in your experience that you realized that you really like to take care of people? Like that is, like the food is not the main star anymore, but it's like this idea of hospitality and yeah. giving to people. What was that moment like?
That moment was actually when I was on the receiving end of it, you know? Like when I went out with my ex-colleagues. Actually, we went out to Le Bon Fang and we sat down. There was like eight of us. And it was just such a great time. Like, you know, you spend so many hours with these guys that you're eating with. And you know, everybody loves food. And you know, everybody loves wine. Everybody's there for a good time. We didn't talk about work. Like the food wasn't like the main showcase, nor the wine. We were just there to have a good time with each other. And that feeling of being so whole and complete, that just brought me back to all the times through my life that, you know, we sat at the dining room, at a dining table with my family. And everything just felt right, you know. Everyone was having a good time. You know, the most important thing wasn't the food. It was the people you were with. And yeah, the food, the service, the wine, the drink. It's all that just to facilitate this fellowship, you know. So then it just clicked for me. Like, that's what I want to create. That's what I want to do. To just have people connect over something that, you know, you make or whatever. Like, it doesn't really matter how... what is in front of them.
Yeah.
But just to provide them the space. I think that, you know, over a meal is probably the best time to have these fellowships. And because everyone is sat down, you know, hopefully people will put their phones away and just be present with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the moment it all clicked for me. And I was like, I just remember having that meal, just slouching down in my chair, like taking myself away from the situation and just looking at it, it was like, yeah,
just basking
like
in it,
this is it, you know.
Yeah,
like this is what it's all about.
Yeah.
So that was the moment.
Yeah. In consideration of the theme we have for this season of the podcast, which is scraps, I take away the idea of scraps as the things that we, as we go through life, we take away from different people.
Mm-hmm.
We experience some things. We go through different jobs and different facets of different lives. And we take away certain things from these people. And we carry them along with us.
Mm-hmm.
That makes us as individuals we are today. So I'm curious to know, has there been someone like a mentor or a figure in your family that has been a supportive individual or has been giving you this sense of motivation to continuously pursue this treacherous path? I watched The Bear. It's so fucking horrible. We can talk about it later, but yeah, it sounds like you're fucking walking into a fire like every day. Yeah, has there been someone a mentor to you? Yeah,
I love the parallel that you drew with scraps and, you know, getting experiences to your life. I love that.
Yeah.
And how, you know, everyone in your life rubs off a certain way on you, and you
take
that on you. Yeah, it becomes but who you are, right? I think for me, I've been very, very lucky all my life to be surrounded by really amazing people.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, starting with my family, with my mom, my dad, and my grandmom. And I think with my dad, I know he always through my life tells me that if you want to do something, do it wholeheartedly or don't do it at all. And growing up, that was very baffling to me because like even the most dumb thing that you had to do as a kid, like your art projects, which doesn't contribute much to your studies. And I was just like, you know, not do it at all or just do it just to get it over with.
Mm-hmm.
And he would like sit me down and like, Ryan, you gotta do it all your heart, okay? You know, if you don't want to do it, let me do it for you. You're painting a picture of fish, Dad. What are you talking about? You know, it's like, no, if you want to do something, just do it with all your heart or don't do it. Like, he always used to go off on my handwriting. It's like, your handwriting is so messy. You know, write better. Take the extra time to write better. And I just want to get it over with so I can go out and play with my friends, you know?
Fair.
But yeah, definitely that attitude has definitely, you know, over the years really resonated with me, and it always stayed in the back of my head. And the second I found something that I love, like that just came and it all makes sense, right? My mom, she is like a hustler. You know, she came from poverty. She was the eldest of five siblings. Her parents, you know, came from a really, really poor background. She had to drop out. She had to drop out of school when she was like 14 or 15 just to take care of her her siblings. She was like the oldest daughter of four other siblings. And so, you know, she couldn't speak English at all. She until she met my dad, and my dad couldn't speak Chinese. Mm. My mom couldn't speak English, and they somehow made it work. And, you know, from a person who doesn't have like her O levels, she's now the only person in my family with a master's degree. Yeah. And, you know, her hustle was really inspirational through my life. Like, I was going through, like I remember being young, and my dad would pick me up after his work, would pack food, we'll go pick my mom up from work, we'll have like dinner by the beach, and then we'll send her to her night classes, get her degree. Mm. And then when I was doing my tests when I was 15, she was doing her master's degrees, and then she aced it. You know, all that while raising two kids, working a full-time job, and you know, she...
You wonder how, like, she does it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, definition of a hustler, right? Mm. Like, wakes up at 5, makes me breakfast. Because I was a fussy kid and didn't want to eat any school food.
Yeah.
Like, I was that fussy. Make me breakfast, take to school. You know, works all day, comes back, make sure that my studies and stuff is in order, teaches me things. When I go to bed, she continues studying on her degree stuff or whatever, and does it every day, you know. So definitely a big inspiration.
Yeah.
You know, going through, I was raised in church. So another big figure in my life was this man named Andre, who I asked to be my godfather, and he, you know, it's just... taught me how to be graceful and kind, and also, you know, how to take care of people, you know. Definitely a big figure in my life. And in my career, I think the most influential person is Kenneth Fung.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the way he ran a kitchen and ran a team really showed me that, you know, there was just not just one way to do it, you know. Like I said, all my life I've been watching Ramsay videos, and, you know, like from the media, there's The Bear, obviously. And even like chefs that I worked with before, chefs that in France that I worked with before, chefs here that I worked with before, who were very like, you know, it was my way or the highway, you know, kind of abusive. Well, emotionally or mentally, or I haven't experienced physical abuse too much.
Too much. Okay. Nice caveat. Yeah.
But yeah, in my head, like, that was pretty much the only way to run a kitchen until Kenneth showed me a different way of running a kitchen.
Mm. What was that way?
Just, you know, lead with humanity, but also you can be a human with very high standards.
Mm.
And you want those standards implemented to the best of your ability, but also be kind enough and graceful enough to understand that everybody has their limitations and everybody's on that journey.
Mm.
And so it's how you mentor them through that journey. Mm. It's a very, I guess, instead of yelling and putting more pressure on to do something, you know, you tone it down a little bit and say, hey, we spoke about this. Why are we not achieving this yet? How can I help you to achieve that?
Mm.
You know, it's a very different approach.
Yeah.
But to me, that really resonated, because finally there's somebody who hears me out, you know, first and foremost, hears me out. And also someone I could trust and respect, who has obviously a lot of expertise.
Yeah.
And someone who can show me on my level, not his level, like on my level, how to get things done, you know. So that was very impactful to me. And that's how I try to manage my team now, I guess. A lot of it is based on what he showed me. And I think just working with him for like a brief 8 months has pushed my career like 2 or 3 years ahead.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was very, very impactful to me. Yeah. I think those are like very important figures in my life. But also, you know, all those friends that I have made who have gave me a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's something that I don't agree with, just having those different perspectives, I guess, has taught me a lot of empathy.
Mm.
Just to be like, even if you don't agree with those perspectives, you can sort of relate to why they're thinking that way.
Yeah.
Or what makes them think that way, or is there another way to do it? So you always keep an open mind, right? Like, like have an opinion until someone gives you a better opinion and then you change your mind, right? It's the same thing. So yeah. I was always very happy to, I'm very blessed to have these people in my life. Yeah.
Yeah. So tangentially to that, I have to ask, what are some attributes you think should be present in a good chef? And has it changed across your journey? Yeah.
Perseverance. Perseverance, self-reflection, and purpose. Like,
I don't hear knife chopping skills or
no, definitely
technicalities
not.
Or like yeah. that. Yeah. Why is that?
100% not technicality, because like technical skills, you know, you can be taught. You can practice. Nobody is born with amazing technicality skills, right? It's the dedication to your craft that makes you want to work on them, right? Mm. So it's attitude that matters above everything else. Like if I have someone who is, you know, who has a great attitude versus someone who has a great skills, I would take a person with great attitude over the person with skills all day long, right? But yeah, I think, what did I say? Perspective? No.
Perseverance.
Perseverance, definitely, because I think in any aspect in life, it's not going to be smooth sailing, right? It's, you show what you can do when you're down at your lowest and how you're going to work through that. Shows a lot of character and that's very admirable. What else did I say? Self-reflection, that always, you know, you always question yourself why you do certain things. Why do you do this? Are you happy where you are? I remember like having my first job in Singapore. I moved here. I was pretty much alone. Didn't know anyone here at that point in time. I used to go to work and obviously like you're fresh out of culinary school. You actually don't know much at all. You know, your skills aren't super great. You know, you're not going to be amazing at dicing onions right off the bat. But you know, I remember I used to question myself every night on the bus ride home. I was like, is this what I want to do?
Those are the worst, man.
Yeah. Is this what I want to do? Am I happy? Will I go back to work tomorrow? And it's always like, yeah, I would. I'm happy. I'm happy now. I can see myself doing this. I'm going to work through it, you know? So self-reflection, knowing who you are and just being honest with yourself, very important. And also, what was the other thing I said?
You said a lot of things.
Well, all right. Anyway. And also, I think an important skill or an important attitude for any young cook or any person or any cook at any level, basically, it's humility and being humble enough to admit that they don't know it all. I don't know it all. And I think just having that mentality to be like, okay, I need help for something, and being humble enough to ask for help, be it from, you know, a senior or a junior. I think that showing people that vulnerability of saying that, of saying you don't know it all, I think it would also create a really good team. Because if you as a leader show vulnerability and say like, I don't know this problem, let me get back to you or let me ask, or even, you know, when you're working on a dish or something and be like, something's missing, I don't really know what it is. Here, taste this, tell me what you think, you know? I believe if you are vulnerable enough with someone genuinely, people are going to do that to you too, you know? So I think that's also a step in being a good chef or a good leader is acknowledging that and allowing your team to be there for you when you need them to. You know, then you can, then you allow them space to grow as well. You know, not just you being the problem solver and putting out fires, you allow people to do that to you too, give them the trust to do that for you as well.
But I would imagine the intricacies of what you, whatever you are, you just said, it takes a lot of time to figure out and a lot of what's the word for it? You have to acknowledge that you're not the main star, even though like you could be the head chef or whatever, but you are still in a team with other people to make the service happen. And you all have to run together, basically.
One thing Kenneth always said, which really resonated with me, is like running service, it's like a race, but it's a race that everyone must finish at the same time. You know? So just, and be it in service or outside of service, you know, you want the whole team to move in the same direction. Yeah, of course, not everyone's going to be at the same pace, but how are you going to let your team be a team for each other? And how you're going to create an environment to allow everyone's space to grow, you know? Because not everyone is in the same stage of their career, obviously. Not everyone is in the same stage of life. So how are you going to create an environment that everyone feels comfortable being themselves and to, you know, lean on each other when they need to and allow other people to fill in for everyone else's weaknesses? And, you know, let people be human beings, right?
Yeah.
Because I really do believe that everyone is on a continuous journey and no one's in like their full, like their final form, you know? So I guess that's my challenge now as a manager, just to create that environment and to keep egos low and being human more.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. I don't know.
Yeah. So for the remaining time we have in this conversation, I want to shift the conversation to food. I'm very curious to know, what does good food mean to you now? Having gone through what you've gone through, has it changed? Does it have to trigger a sudden sense of nostalgia? Does it have to trigger something in you? Because you mentioned earlier in the conversation with Christy about it has to touch something tangible within you. Yeah, so what does that mean for you as a consumer and as a chef where you're preparing these dishes for people that you might not have spoken to before?
Like, what is good food to me?
Yeah, as a consumer, yeah.
As a consumer. Okay, well, when I was a young cook, I was always very, like, there was a switch that I couldn't turn off, right? And that this...
A metaphorical or physical?
Metaphorical switch in my head.
Gotcha.
That, like, I judge everything from like a arrogant point of view, like, oh, I'm a chef, so this coleslaw that KFC makes is a shit coleslaw.
Admittedly, their coleslaws are pretty shit, but sure, yeah, I get your point.
It's not a coleslaw because it's not done right and, you know, shit like that. But I think acknowledging that KFC made the coleslaw to fit a certain, you know, to fulfill a certain gap in the market. Yeah, sure. Like, so I think, through great friends that I had, they showed me that I'm an arrogant prick for doing that, for thinking that way.
Yeah.
Just because I can cook doesn't mean I'm better than anyone else. So I was like, yeah, it's definitely a point. I sound like a dick. So trained myself to turn that switch off, and to be like, you know, I think all food is good.
Yeah.
It just annoys me that some places try to rip you off.
What is
like,
that?
Like, I hate talking bad about people, but recently I just had like a really bad dining experience in KL for my girlfriend's birthday.
Okay.
And it was like this 5-star hotel, right?
Yeah.
And so I was very excited. I booked her a surprise dinner. We went there and it was like a steakhouse and we had a couple of appetizers.
Yeah.
A steak and a dessert, right? So the appetizers, one was like a scallop dish and one was a tartare, a Wagyu tartare, right? And these are like not cheap. These are like 5-star hotels, right? And so I think for one appetizer, a scallop appetizer, I spent like 150 ringgit for like 3 pieces of scallops that were covered in breadcrumbs and flambéed at the table. But the flambé process was like, they take a copper pot with alcohol inside and they use a blowtorch to burn it off. So obviously the alcohol is not going to be burnt off. And then you pour that on the scallops with the breadcrumbs on top. The breadcrumbs going to burn. Alcohol is not going to be, you know, burnt off. And then you're serving me these pieces, 3 pieces of scallops for 150 ringgit. So it was like 50 ringgit for scallops, right? And you're a 5-star hotel. Like, it was inedible. Like, my girlfriend spat it out. So I was like, okay, like, yeah, this is not good food. This is like, you're trying to cheat your customer just because you're hiding behind the facade of being a 5-star hotel doesn't give you the right to sell me these things that I know in my head as a chef from a chef, like, it's not up to par. Like, so like with that switch turned on, I'll be like, okay, this is not good. This is a scam because you're serving me like rubbish scallops, which on the menu you say they are hand dived, and then you're charging me an exorbitant amount of money for this, and it's inedible. It's not good. But from like a consumer point of view, I was like, this is a ripoff. You know? So that's not good. But I believe that any food that is made edible and, you know, it doesn't make you want to gag is good food.
Yeah.
You know, it's perfectly fine. It's it's just when the price and the product does not match.
Yep.
Then that's where I have a problem.
Yep.
You know? But what is good food to me as a consumer is just food that definitely brings up an emotion. Mm. But again, that's me thinking of food from like a just food on its own point of view, you know? Like, but like I said earlier, like now it's never about just the food. It's about the company with the food. The food is just like a supporting role.
Yeah.
So I focus more on the time that I spend with people over food rather than the food itself.
Yep.
However, if I do want to turn that switch on and be like a
critic, yeah.
A critic.
Yeah.
The food I enjoy most is this food that bring up a certain feeling of comfort and of wonder.
Mm.
I think working with food so much, you almost get desensitized to because you work with it every day. You know, you take it for granted. You know, you're tasting fucking Wagyu tartare every day. You know, you get numb. You have like really tasty steaks.
Yeah.
Right.
Would the opposite be true then? You want something trashy just to
offset? 100%, yeah. Of course. I mean, yeah. I definitely have trashy food, but like, but like when a craftsman or a really good chef, you know, makes you, like you go eat at a really nice place or even any place, even like a, you know, like a warung, and you have, for me, you have food that brings up that joy and that excitement that I first had when I first started cooking, that is so special to me.
Mm.
You know? Like, you eat it and you're like, wow, this is so good. How did you do this? You know? Like, it blows your mind. You're wondering, like, what's your secret? What are you doing right that I'm not?
Mm.
You know? Like, this is so good, but you just appreciate it and you just want to give them a hug. Like, thank you, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, yeah, through every price point, every category of food, you have moments like that.
Yeah.
And that's so special.
Yeah.
You know, I think that is like the best form of food when something makes you feel a certain way.
Yeah.
I think same with like music or poetry or whatever, right? That's like something that
it resonates.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have to ask, as a chef, if you're preparing a menu or if you're preparing a dish for someone, how do you infuse, how do you look to infuse the sense of emotion? Because I don't think you can buy it off the shelf.
Yeah, but...
And it's so unique to the individual.
Of course.
But what goes through your head through that process?
I learned to not think about what other people feel.
Fair.
I feel like as a chef, that there's so many feelings, whether or not people might feel a certain way or not. But I think as a cook, I just look for food that make me feel a certain way. You know, I cook what I like and what I want to eat.
Yeah.
Yeah, the caveat that I might ask like my team to like make a dish that you know, because it's not just about me, it's about the whole team, right?
Yeah.
And sorry, I got blurred. What was the question again? I think we need to cut this out.
How do you look to infuse the sense of emotion or emotionality into the food that you cook for someone?
So you can't, I don't believe that you can put emotion to every dish that you make.
Okay.
You know, you do put out so many dishes that you do resonate with certain dishes more than others. You know, I think of like building dishes with like, you know, the blocks are my ingredients and my flavors, right? So I want to work with the seasons. So more like European seasons, like Northern Hemisphere, right? So now it's going to be autumn. So coming autumn, I know pumpkin's going to be great. Apples, pears, mushrooms are great. So, you know, I do want to use the best of those flavors at its season to make something good.
Yeah.
And then the infusion of emotion through it part comes to like things that I have fond memories of growing up. But it's not always the case, right? And I do believe that, you know, your brain is a place where you have ideas but not store them. So I always have like a list in my phone of dishes that I just come in my head while ruminating and not thinking about food at all. And then I save those ideas. And then every time I need a dish to fill in a gap in the menu, I would go through this list and just see what makes sense.
Yeah.
And then you put that on. So it's rare that you get a dish on the menu with a lot of my emotion in it. Because it's, you know, I look at it from maybe at one point it was emotional when I write it down or the inspiration that comes by. But by that point in the creative process, most of the feelings are diluted.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think recently a dish that I had very fond memories of was like a pasta dish, but it was inspired by palak paneer.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So it was just like the flavors of palak paneer. You have spinach. I have spinach in a dough, a ricotta filling that was very similar to the taste of the paneer. And then, you know, like a spiced tomato sauce to go with it. You know, so it doesn't look like palak paneer at all, but when you eat it, it sort of gives you that emotion. But yeah, like I said, like the emotion part was like, I love palak paneer. I always eat it when I go to Indian restaurants. But by the time it makes the menu, like a lot of the emotions are diluted out. But the emotions is what I look for inspiration, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you mentioned your craft menu. So you craft food items with like seasonality of the ingredients in mind. I would assume this is highly intentional because in today's day and age, you can almost get any ingredient that you want.
Yeah.
And in hearing and in talking to different chefs, when you talk about certain recipes that maybe their family have, there is usually the element of scarcity, or we only have these things, we'll make something to do with it. And I think across the years, when people grow up with it, there is like this, what's the word for it? Affection towards it. Mm-hmm. But it started out of necessity, started out of scarcity. So I think in trying to close out this conversation, do you think about like the fact that we're living in an era where you can almost have any ingredient you want? Does that kind of hinder your creativity, or do you prefer to set up like the boundaries? I can only work with these sets of ingredients. I want to make something beautiful out of it.
No, I do believe that yeah, you can get anything at any point in time now, but I do believe that certain ingredients are going to taste best in a certain season. Right, you're not gonna get like amazing, you're not gonna get amazing scallops in the summertime. You know, like scallops are best in winter because the waters that they are in are super cold, and so they grow more fatty. So, like, can you recreate this environment in which you have super cold water for the scallops to go all year round? Yes, but at what cost? Right, like that's gonna take a lot of energy. You know, and then it's not sustainable. And so I guess a part of sustainability, right, is also using things when they're at the most abundant and they're the best. So those are the things that only happen in season, right? So I do believe in setting parameters around your creativity, because I think that the best dishes come from like ideas with boundaries, or is that the right way to say it? I don't know. But I think if you have like unlimited resources and unlimited ingredients or whatever, I think it's going to dampen creativity in a sense. I think giving yourself limits would push you further. Even like some of the best dishes, right, like are born out of necessity, like what you said, like because like of poverty, you know, you're how you use your scraps and stuff. You know, some of the best dishes come out from those. Some of the best tasting dishes come out from the communities with the highest rate of poverty, you know? So I think because of necessity, or rather how you recreate that environment of restraint, would propel you forward even further than having no restraints.
Do you feel that there is too much of a focus on the luxuriousness of certain ingredients? Like there's too much of a focus that, oh, because I am using X particular ingredient, my dish is supposedly better than something else that doesn't have that particular ingredient.
Yeah, 100%. I think the same way, like that story that I told you about how that restaurant could get away with it because they're a 5-star hotel and they're hide behind a facade. I think a lot of dishes hide behind, oh, you know, like we shave a lot of truffles on it, so it has to be good and we can sell it for a certain price. oh, it has truffle oil in it. Oh, that's the worst. You know, like fucking shoestring fries.
Yeah.
With truffle oil, it's like $20 more expensive than regular fries. But it's truffle oil is so mass produced, you know. Mm. It's just like, I have truffle in this dish. It's meant to be luxurious.
Yeah.
So yeah, 100%. But that being said, if you use it correctly, it's bloody delicious, you know. But again, it's just the intention of how you use those ingredients, right? If you use it just to, if you use it to drain more money out of a consumer rather than to like, to use it purposefully,
yeah,
you know, that's the difference. I think that's where a chef's expertise would matter.
I think my last question to you is, has there been an ingredient or an underutilized ingredient that you would like to utilize more in perhaps a future dish? Has there been an ingredient like that in mine, or an ingredient that it isn't commonly used this way, or isn't commonly used in a conventional way? Has there been an ingredient like that?
I don't think there's any ingredient that is like uncommonly used. It's just basically the context in which it's used, right? So like, say for example, bois calotte, right? You hardly see it in a French restaurant, because obviously bois calotte is not French. But in certain contexts right now, in certain restaurants, it's very used, because it's like the whole trend of being super local, like what Noma did back then, and now a lot of local restaurants are doing, right? Of being super local and championing local ingredients. Like, I love that. It's great. I guess what I like to do for myself is, how am I going to use that ingredient smartly in a dish that is not local? So how am I going to incorporate that into something that you would still see and still read off the menu as very Eurocentric, because that's the brand of, that's our brand.
Yeah.
So something that's very Eurocentric and something that would, that you would taste and be reminded of the original thing, but maybe I use a local ingredient, you know, in it. So an example is like a, what is that sauce called? All right, there's a sauce called a sauce Monier. It's basically like brown butter with shallots, capers, and lemon juice, and you eat it with a fish, mostly. And parsley. So I thought, and during that moment, you know, we were making some staff meal with, like, you know, the fermented black beans. So I was like, all right, the point of the capers in this recipe is just bring some salinity and some depth to the sauce. So I was like, all right, what if I replace that with the black beans? Because it works the same way capers does, right? It brings some umami and some depth and salinity to the dish. So I did that and it worked, like, seamlessly. It's like a straight substitute.
Yeah.
And you eat that with prawns or fish or whatever, and it's delicious. So I guess that's how I think of food. Like, how am I going to use not an underutilized ingredient, but like a ingredient that is out of context, and incorporate that smartly into a very Eurocentric reading and tasting dish.
Yeah. Yeah. But I would imagine for that to work effectively, your knowledge, or rather your breadth of knowledge of what is even available, you would have to be, you will have to kind of be able to play around with it and be open with it.
Well, I don't know. Yes, to a point, but I wouldn't say like my mastery of local ingredients is that great. I just think you need to be open enough to be open and present enough to catch those moments when they do happen.
I see.
Like, the only reason I thought about black beans for that dish was because we were using it for a staff meal.
Ah.
Then I was like, huh, what if I just did this?
Yeah.
You know, I think like, if you sit down and you force yourself to make these connections, it's hardly going to happen. Yep. But if you allow yourself like an idea and you allow it to ruminate, then you would, like, these ideas will slowly come to you.
It's like,
you
know? Cooking.
Like, yeah, it's just natural.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's when you get an idea. And that's when you write it down.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you get back to it like maybe a year from now, whatever. Yep. Yeah. But I think allowing yourself to ruminate on these thoughts, or creating a system in which you have to write down these ideas, is very important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful. That's a perfect way to end. Thank
Lovely.
You.
Thank you.
And that marks the end of our conversation with Ryan today. Thank you for tuning in to the first episode of Guacamole, a short podcast series by The Slow Press and Neighbor. Remember to share it with your friends if it sparked your curiosity. We'll see you in a bit for the next episode. Goodbye.